And I believe in trust, I believe in love. And I believe in poetry, and I believe.
You're listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tamara Kramer, and Shtetl is a Yiddish word that means small town or village, and Shtetl on the Shortwave is a show about Jewish arts and culture out of Montreal. Stay tuned.
I believe in the Father, the Son, and Holy Ghost, and I believe in lager, cigarettes, and dope. Yeah, I believe in love. And you believe in your prophet, and you believe in your pope, and you believe in your guru, and I believe and hope that you believe, that I believe that you believe in love. Cause I believe in anything if I believe that you believe in love. Well, I believe in stoners, and I believe in saints, and I believe in sarcomas, and I believe in opiates. Yeah, I believe.
Welcome to Shtetl on the Shortwave. We've got a great show lined up for you today. There's a lot of amazing things happening in Montreal, in Jewish arts and culture in general, and at Shtetl on the Shortwave. Lots of new stuff. I wanted to announce to everybody that there's some big changes happening. There's going to be a whole new Shtetl website with a magazine all related to Jewish arts and culture, and that's going to be launched on March 4th. Also, on March 10th, Shtetl on the Shortwave is collaborating with none other than the Jewish Public Library of Montreal. We are bringing in a documentary film called Who the Jew Are You? And the director will be there from Vancouver to introduce the film and to discuss it with a Q&A after, and there'll be some wine and cheese bagels. So I hope that people can come out to that, and you can call the Jewish Public Library for tickets. And that brings us to today's show. Right now in Toronto, there's an exhibit going on called Graphic Details, and it's all women who've done memoirs in graphic novel style, all Jewish women, and you can see that until April 17th. And today on the show, we're going to be talking with one of the artists featured in the exhibit, and her name is Bernice Eisenstein. She's written a book called I Am the Child of Holocaust Survivors, and it's a graphic novel and a memoir, and it's beautifully written and drawn, and it's a very touching book with also a lot of humor. And she talks about her experience as the child of Holocaust survivors in a unique way, and it's definitely worth getting your hands on if you can. It's also been made into a short film that was chosen by the Toronto International Film Festival this year as one of the best 10 short films of the year. So we're going to be talking with Bernice Eisenstein in Toronto in a couple of moments. But before we do, I wanted to play a song for you by a woman named Lucy Kaplansky. She is going to be in Montreal on March 4th at La Sala Rosa. She started out just as a songwriter and playing in bars in Chicago, and she moved herself to New York City where she got into the music scene, and she was really, really making it and playing with people like Suzanne Vega. But at a certain point, she decided that the music fast track wasn't for her, and she dropped out and went to grad school and became a psychologist. But she never gave up her love of music, and she came out with a new album most recently, Over the Hills. This is a song off of the album. It's called Somewhere Trouble Don't Find Me. It's Lucy Kaplansky, and we'll be back on Shtetl on the Shortwave after this with Bernice Eisenstein.
Time for this. inside. I said, sorry, I got to ride. Sorry, but I got to ride. You know you could end up dead, sleeping in the devil's bed. Sleeping in the devil's bed. Take me somewhere trouble don't go. Make me someone trouble don't go. But she wants to go too far. But she wants to go too far. First comes love, it's so fine. Then comes heartache right behind. Here comes heartache right behind. Baby used to be so sweet. Now she won't come down my street. Now she won't come down my street. All my plans got derailed. She locked up my heart in jail. She locked up my heart in jail.
She locked up my heart in jail.
Take me somewhere trouble don't go. Make me somewhere trouble don't know. Take me somewhere trouble don't go. Make me somewhere trouble don't know.
So that was Lucy Kaplansky, Somewhere Trouble Don't Find Me, and she's going to be playing at the Sala Rosa on March 4th. She did sound a little bit like Suzanne Vega, actually, I thought. Anyways, we're back on Shtetl on the Shortwave, and we're going to be talking with Bernice Eisenstein in just a moment. She's the author of I Was a Child of Holocaust Survivors, which is at the Graphic Details exhibit in Toronto, opened last night. And we've got Bernice on the phone right now. Are you there, Bernice?
I am here.
Welcome to Shtetl on the Shortwave.
Would you hate it if I said I'm not here?
I really, that's the moment that I really, really don't look forward to on the show when there's nobody there. But thank God you're here.
Phones work. Nice to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you too. So last night was the opening of the exhibit, as I was just saying. How did it go?
Oh, it was just fantastic. I know I'm talking to Montreal. It was at the Gladstone Hotel. Mm-hmm. It's downtown in Toronto. It's a beautiful venue. In the hotel, it feels it's very urban, and the way that it's set up is almost like a salon. There's little rooms where each room has a number of the artists shown, so you flow in and out, and the rooms allow you to look at the work that's there, see it as art, read it, hear the conversation of the artists. There were lots of people there. It's a beautifully installed exhibition.
I had actually a couple of months ago had two of the other artists on the show, and their work addresses very different subjects than yours. It was Julie Sandel, I think her name is, and she wrote a memoir about her father and how he had sort of deceived her whole life about his identity, and
right.
Also Miriam Lebicki, another Canadian artist who wrote about her experience as an IDF soldier in the army. So very different from what you wrote about. Your book is a unique memoir. I've never actually read a graphic novel like it. It's really beautifully written, and it's sort of a mix of writing and pictures. It's not like a comic the whole way through.
No, even though there is, I'll say, not an insert like but a section that's a panel from beginning to end. There's an 18-page section that's in there, but even that's not so traditional because it's non-linear.
Uh-huh. What made you want to write this book? I know a lot of people have fantasized about the idea of looking back at their life and telling the story of themselves and their families. How did you decide to tell this very difficult story?
Do we have hours to talk about this?
Definitely.
To be as a direct answer of how it first started, the book didn't begin as a book. It began, I'm an artist, I, you know, work visually. So I began doing paintings of my father. He'd been dead a number of years, and it was just a moment where, with the work I was doing, I decided to do some portraits of him to capture a quality about him rather than a direct way that he looks. And in the process of doing those paintings, you have a lot of conversations. You know, being in your studio is a very, very private, large terrain. So in the kind of conversation I was hearing, a lot of, I was talking to him, I was in his company. So from that, this conversation unfolded to about his past, our relationship, what I knew about him, what I didn't know. And from that, it kept growing into his marriage, you know, to my mother, their relationship, our family history. So it became a very large conversation that I knew I needed words, and I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that began a very operatic dance mm-hmm. between word and picture. Also, I have to say, what opened up was this process of memory that I was engaging in that I wanted to stay with. I mean, there's lots of reasons why the book became, but that's like an originating place.
Okay.
Starting from image and then truly wanting two languages to speak as deeply as I could, mm-hmm. create something as deeply as I could.
Okay, and it's interesting. I get the sense in the book that talking to your parents, and in particular your father, about his past was something that he really wasn't able to do so easily.
Difficult.
So,
yeah. The book actually stems from like a feeling of longing. I missed him.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it also it begins from a sense of loss and dealing with that in a very private way. So then it deals with loss in a greater way. His losses, like, you know, from the war, the whole family's losses, the people I grew up with. You know, when I was young, when all of them first came to Canada, I only knew survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's great that you've got Shtetl with Shtetl Radio.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Shtetl in Toronto.
Yeah. It was like a whole world unto itself, by the way.
Completely.
You just, mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, when you go through into memory, you want to recoup and discover both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you stay with it and listen. There's much to learn.
There are some amazing stories that you shared in the book, and I was wondering if you might be willing to give some context to the listeners, a little bit of history about your parents. How did they meet? And a little bit of their stories of where they're from.
Okay. Both my parents are from Poland, small towns. My mother's from Benjin. My father was from Miechow. They met, obviously we're gliding really quickly over a lot of, like, bits of information, but they met in Auschwitz. My father came to Auschwitz from Plaszow at the end of the war. Like, he came in the last year of the war. My mother, from Benjing, when it was first ghettoized and when the ghetto was liquidated, she with her family, with her mother and her sister and her brother, arrived in Auschwitz in 43. So she was there prior to him. Her brother did not survive selection. At one point, my mother was separated from her mother and her sister. So she was on her own with just some friends at the very end of the war. So we're going right down to, you know, imminently, like a week before liberation.
Like 1945.
Of Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And that's when they met. She was in hiding. He had remained with some other friends, staying around to, you know, to do whatever they could do. And ultimately, he saved her. I mean, she came out at a moment from where she was hiding. She and her friends were found out, and my father basically rescued her, and that's their love story. They met at camp. and they stayed together from there on.
Wow,
that's how they met.
And
once liberated, and very common to many, many survivors. Once liberated, you know, you're told you're free, you can go. There's nowhere to go. They ultimately went to were in Bergen-Belsen. After the war, Bergen-Belsen became I think the largest DP camp.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, people then, that was the place where they began making a life. Mm-hmm. And it's truly of life beginning. My sister was born there.
Wow.
And they emigrated in 48 to Canada.
It's
and then I was born.
And then you were born in Toronto?
That's right.
In Kensington Market?
That's right.
It's fun to yeah, it was really fun in the book to hear you describing Kensington Market at that time and your father's work plucking chickens, and it sounds like it was it's an interesting time in Toronto's history.
You know, it's flavored. It's beautiful because, you know, if you fill into that, you know, we're talking about a lot of sorrow in the past. You know, constantly what's going on is people are making new lives.
Mm-hmm.
So in the family, that's the sense of it. You know, I've always said, you know, my parents' life was tragic, not mine. The beauty is, I mean, they were, you know, let's say as operatic as they were in their own emotions, were deeply loving parents. You know, it's easy to distill quickly to what's important,
mm-hmm.
and that's the inheritance. So I think that's I've always thought the survivors themselves, the ones I grew up with, are the greatest testimony to human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they made families, they made lives, they worked hard, they wanted the best for their children, they trusted the new country they came to.
It's unbelievable because, I mean, every time you hear somebody's testimony, as we do in your book, we hear about your mother and your father, and it's very hard to relate to and to understand how somebody could have hope and move on after experiencing all those things and losing a whole family. I guess that's something that you sort of witnessed, and I guess that's something that's given you a lot of hope, because I can't even imagine how somebody could move on after something like that.
Well, hope's a great word, because, I mean, there are people who haven't in many ways, or you know, everybody deals with their tragedies in great variety.
Mm-hmm.
But these were also the group, you know, we kept calling them the group, that's how they were known. You know, you go to a bar mitzvah or a wedding or a bris, and they're all there. They celebrate it at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just so happy to do it. But you just also feel it evokes a constant undercurrent, and you know, you see all those dualities. So my attempt in the book was to show the dualities, the many time frames that are ever present.
Was it cathartic to write this book? Was it difficult? And also the fact that, like right now, mm-hmm. you're asked to talk about it over and over again. I wonder if that's something that's good for you, or that you find healing in some way?
It's a big question. On one hand, it's like cathartic is not the word that I think of, because, and I may be misinterpreting it, but I think, you know, a sense of catharsis is if you have dealt with something and then you put it behind, like move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of it like that. It's learning more from what's there. It's sort of going deeper into it, and in the best way, a kind of embrace means going with it. You know, it made my sensibility. It's why I have a very black sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
why I have deep love for a whole group of people, I have a regard for literature, have a regard for let's say the teachings of the wisdom, where you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
So all those are good, strong things.
In the book, I think one of the more humorous, and I know it's not humorous in fact, but the way you presented it was kind of funny. the concept that you grew up as an addict, you were addicted to H, and your parents were the peddlers. Can you sort of explain that concept to people?
It's not an easy one to explain, other than to say I do not have needle marks on my arm. as an artist, to be creative with something I wanted to say, I took it to an extreme. You know, like I kind of ran with it as a jazz riff. But at the same time, it's meeting it head on. Yes, there's an addiction that won't let go. The Holocaust is always there with all the questions that it presents in its importance of understanding and how it affects you, and you kind of dance around the monolith. So the irony is also I'm dealing with the, you know, the message of never forget, but it's never forget, but you're not telling me more. Like, how much should I be knowing about this thing?
Mm-hmm.
So from early on, let's say that interest grows like an addiction. And I'll say within that addiction, how we're using it like in quote marks, I'm finding other great works of writing, great literature, great thinking, great heart, great poetry. So it's a very rich addiction,
mm-hmm.
but an important one, because there's no walking away from it. There's something, we want the world to be better. I mean, that's the simplest way I can put it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's forever there. You know, it's not there every minute, but certainly within my having made a book, I stayed with that.
Right.
Center to it.
It's something that is important to hold on to. It's actually, it's a positive
memory.
Addiction, quote unquote.
Well, I think in that way, you're sort of a guardian of the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're at a point where the survivors they're more than aged and they're dying. There's very few. So there's a responsibility of memory, not only, I mean, specific to myself, this is my direct lineage. I have children. But I also think in terms of collective memory. You
mm-hmm.
know, it raises other new questions. How do we become responsible to that? Again, I'll say the best thing is, you know, how do we evolve in the face of the terrible things that are done? I mean, evolve as people.
How do you react when people say things like they have Holocaust fatigue, like they're tired of seeing films about it, or they're tired of seeing novels about it? Because you do hear people saying that, and I wonder how somebody... Yeah, how do you react to that?
I have many reactions. I mean, one is like, wake up and smell the Holocaust. it depends who I'm talking to. I mean, I always have, you know, there's a lot of thought balloons going off over my head. One thing I would say, some of the greatest literature that's been written comes from there. I mean, Andre Schwarzbart's Last of the Just is one of the finest books written, period. Primo Levi has Periodic Table is just unbelievable, plus everything else he's written.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much there. I'd say, I'd ask them, what are you reading, what are you thinking about?
Mm-hmm.
The fatigue, it's like, you know, what else are you sleeping through?
Mm-hmm.
I could go on.
I wish you would, because I think it's something that you hear a lot about, and people say, well, haven't we heard enough about the Holocaust, since there's so many other, you know, other things going on in the world, other genocides that continue to happen? Shouldn't we focus more on that?
And... But then pair it together. I mean, it depends what kind of conversation somebody wants to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, find something there. If they want to talk about Rwanda, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from it what it shows is, see, we haven't learned. We can go, you know, go back, go from year dot. You know, maybe the flood existed for a reason.
Right.
In the Bible. I guess I'd want to slow the conversation down after I had a knee-jerk, like, joke to say
mm-hmm.
of what are you thinking about? What do you think is not there to be learned? Or, there's some stuff that I'd probably say, yeah, that was a schlocky movie. I'm very critical of some stuff that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, not again, or is that going on to the back of, just pushing the envelope, like, you know, because it exists, another movie is made. There's reasons. You want to slow down and say, well, what is the thing itself about? What is it offering?
Mm-hmm.
You could, of course, you should be critical of what it is. But as a blanket statement, it's a blanket over too many valid, important things.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of troubling.
It's very troubling.
Yeah. Talking about movies, you mentioned sort of like the different reaction that you would have to a movie about the Holocaust versus
yeah.
how your parents, who had actually been through it, how they reacted, like, to Sophie's Choice.
Yeah, they're clinical. It's like, oh, yep, that's what I should look like. Yes, there was that much mud. That's a very interesting thing from survivors, seeing, like, that's not the real mnemonic for them that takes them really into their loss. and, you know, they need that little bit of a distance. Then when I come to my father and I've seen it, I'm just red-eyed and just weeping incredibly. And as I said in the book, his response as a father, saying, why would you want to do that to yourself? That's him being protective, mm-hmm. as all parents want. You know, this happened to us. We don't want those harms, the way we've been touched by it, for you to know.
I guess that's the contradiction. It's like, never forget.
Yeah.
But, you know, but at the same time, like, don't obsess over it. Like, it's a difficult message to absorb, I guess, as a child, you know.
But I think I also flipped it in the book at one point. I mean, you write and you discover things. Never forget has become remember us. Mm-hmm. That's how I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wanting to listen to that in the best way. And added to that are the statements of, I grew up with L'chaim at the drop of a hat. You know, it's like, it's always to see the ironies of things. Never forget, there's been so much loss. There's been all these tragedies. Then let's dance. Let's celebrate life. I always say, like, there's a Yiddish thing. I'm not going to say in Yiddish, but it's, the English is, there is no greater heart than a broken heart.
How do you say it in Yiddish?
I'm just too famished now, just being nervous talking to you. But it's a beautiful phrase of, mm-hmm. When you think of what all that comes from a broken heart,
mm-hmm.
well, there's the healing, there's the love that's there, there's the spirit to go on. That's, you know, that's what all of us inherit. So you learn it from loss.
Mm-hmm. Your mother, I think she had a different way of talking about the Holocaust than your father did. It was easier for her?
I don't know easier, but she was able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been, her section is my recounting in her voice as best as I could. The testimony she gave for, you know, the archives when a lot of survivors were being interviewed and archived on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just able to sit and chronologically answer questions, give the story, which is a great thing to have. And she's, my father was like was more silent. English was never came easy to him. He always, it's a major Yinglish he spoke.
Okay.
And I've always found that the women who come to this country, they learn English great. So she was able to go to the facts and the storytelling.
You did tell her story beforehand. I sort of got the feeling like your whole father's family had perished in the war, and that she hadn't suffered much the same loss at all and hadn't experienced as much at all, and she was less affected by it and because she hadn't experienced as much. But then when you actually, you know, tell her recounting the story, it's unbelievable what she actually went through. And I guess her way of holding it in the world was just very, very different and quite heroic, it seemed to me.
And then when I think, because we were talking about what's within their marriage, my father was the strength of her life.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it reversed. He saved her. As quiet as my father was, he was a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very kind of brave man, very, very black and white. This is good. This isn't good. These are good people. These are not good people. There was something very solid and reliable about it. He was ferociously protective. Yeah.
I encourage people to read the book. It was an easy book to get through in terms of just, it was a page turner and beautiful to read and to look at the drawings. So I encourage people to go online. Where could they go to buy the book online?
I guess Amazon.ca.
Amazon.ca? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
it's there.
It's there. And also, again, there's the movie that's going around and doing the festival circuit, the short film about the book.
Yes, animated short. It's 15 minutes long. I think of it as like a small bag of popcorn. but I'm very pleased with it. It's lovely. It's getting its own life now through the festival circuit.
Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for coming onto the show, Bernice.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Tamara.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye. So that was Bernice Eisenstein, and I was so happy when I went to the line and she was really there. It's always a pleasure. It was nice to talk with her, and the book is really amazing. I definitely recommend people pick it up. I was a child of Holocaust survivors. And we're going to go in a bit of a different direction for the second half of the show. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to be back after this song from one of Montreal's, you know, a small band in Montreal, one that we really love a lot. And we'll be back on Shtetl on the Shortwave with Yehuda Mirsky.
Hello there. This is Annie Sprinkle, and you are listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT. And I am wishing you a great, big, juicy Valentine's Day, and here's a big kiss. Mwah!
So that's our little Montreal band, Arcade Fire, that we're so proud of right now. And we're always proud of them. They're pretty awesome. But I particularly wanted to play that song today because it's off of their album, The Suburbs. And that's a perfect segue to the second half of the show, where we're going to be talking about a book called The New Jews. And it's an anthology of essays by radical Jews. It was published in 1971 by Random House. And the essays sort of look at how disenchanted and alienated a lot of these young Jewish intellectuals were from middle-class suburban Judaism. And I talked to Yehuda Mirsky about the book because I first heard of it in an article that he wrote in an online magazine called Jewish Ideas Daily. I was sort of curious to find out if the writing in the book was relevant to what maybe some Jewish people or young Jewish people today might be feeling in terms of institutional Judaism. And so I I called him up and he agreed to come on the show. So the clip we're going to hear right now is my interview with him in Jerusalem. Yehuda Mirsky is a pretty impressive man. He studied at Yale. He got his PhD in religion from Harvard. He worked as an aide to Al Gore. He worked in the Clinton administration. And he is also a fellow at a think tank in Jerusalem that focuses on democracy in Israel. We spoke about the new Jews and what they might have to say to us today. Take a listen. This is Yehuda Mirsky in Jerusalem.
The series of essays, all very well written, by then young Jewish radicals. These were young people, young men, and it turns out they were all men, because there was still, a lot still had yet to happen by 1971, who were in very deep sympathy with the whole melange of revolutionary forces that we call the 60s. And were sort of generationally very much at one with the New Left, with its criticism of corporate America, consumerist America, suburban America, what was regarded as American imperialism, the alienation of American life and capitalism. But at the same time, what makes them very interesting is that they were also very Jewishly committed, and much of their critique of they had a very powerful critique of Jewish establishment life as they saw it, federations, JCCs, suburban synagogues with huge parking lots, mainstream American Judaism. What was really interesting was that rather than sort of junking all of it, they wanted to try and see if they could think their way towards a more meaningful relationship with Jewish tradition, with traditional culture, Yiddishkeit, etc., not in an orthodox way, but in a way that would somehow elicit or engage with vital energies from the tradition in ways that would, on the one hand, give them a sense of grounding and authenticity and commitment, and, interestingly, keep their own political radicalism from lapsing into a kind of solipsistic, nihilistic, self-loving, self-congratulatory kind of thing, as we know the New Left often and disastrously did. So that's why I found it very, very interesting to look at it 40 years later.
Definitely. And I think myself and a lot of the listeners are going to want to read the book. I'm very curious to go out and see what they had to say. I found a quote that was from the book from James Sleeper that said, right, that compared or characterized Judaism to a spiritual Hiroshima, which had been the setting for the transformation of the Hebrew spirit into an increasingly dispensable appendage of middle class culture. Right. Do you feel like the book had anything to teach us today? Do you feel like it was really too radical? Where do you stand? What are your feelings about what they wrote in the book?
70s are when the 60s start moving into mainstream culture. A lot of stuff in the 60s was actually percolating in the 50s. Now, in the music, of course, in the civil rights movement, but also intellectually. And here, and as I mentioned in the article, in 1955, there was this really interesting book, and still a classic of American religious sociology, called Protestant Catholic Jew, published by a fellow named Will Herbert. So in 1955, Herbert published this article this book that had sort of two arguments. When we said Protestant Catholic Jew, he said that America had managed to sort of create, to take the diversity of religious traditions on its shores and kind of amalgamate them into this one kind of bland Eisenhower-era thing called the American way of life. Everybody, mainstream Protestants acting like mainstream Protestants, but most everyone else acting like mainstream Protestants as well, and sort of a great identification of religious values with American middle class, et cetera, consumer values. But he also predicted that third generation immigrants, the grandchildren of immigrants, would be returning to religious tradition. That once they were sufficiently assimilated and at home in America, they would be looking back towards the religious and spiritual traditions that their grandparents or parents had checked at Ellis Island as sources of sustenance. And he turned out to be very right about that in many ways. And that's very much what's happening in this, that you see these third-generation American, young American intellectuals and activists offering these very, you know, very impassioned critiques of sort of the pieties and the conventions, et cetera, of American middle-class life and of the kind of Judaism that it yielded, you know, the sort that, you know, I'm sure you and many of your listeners have seen, you know, the Coen brothers, A Serious Man, you know, which is, of course, you know, it's a slightly, but a sometimes one senses only slightly exaggerated version of what suburban Jewish life was in the mid-60s. And so you have these young people who really are, you know, trying. So they are part of their generation. They're rebelling against what they see as this sort of very vapid and often regularly immoral American way of life. And yet, what's interesting is that in looking for resources for their own social, political, and spiritual thinking, they are going back to the tradition. And in a way, their very Americanness gives them a kind of freedom that they feel they can allow themselves, right? They're sufficiently assimilated and enculturated into America that they feel that they can allow themselves to reengage with tradition and to reengage with it on their own terms. Right, they don't simply have to become Orthodox or something like that. They can do their own very creative things with it. Now, in some ways, the revolution didn't quite happen, right? You know, here we are 40 years on. You know, there's still federations, there's still suburban synagogues, there's still all of that stuff. Though, a lot of what the Jewish community has managed to do is it's managed to sort of make use of or incorporate or internalize a lot of the criticisms that these guys were making, right? So that it's in Jewish organizational life, it's, you know, far more common now to hear people talking about serious things with Jewish texts. Social justice in the form of Tikkun Olam, you know, is like all anyone can talk about, for better or worse. And obviously, you know, the world of the Chaburot that these fellows were all very involved in, you know, sort of has made its mark. So things like the Chaburot had a real effect on American Jewry. Those sort of the large, you know, sort of these large currents of American middle class life still go on, and I think there's reasons why they go on.
I'm just wondering, who would you characterize as the new Jews today? Who are the radical Jews today, and how are they different from the old new Jews, as you called them?
On the one hand, there are some obvious candidates, right? Say, sort of this whole class of like Jewish social entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not quite radicals. No, they're making very interesting and innovative uses of technology and trying to think about organizational life in different kinds of ways and in less formally structured and less hierarchical kinds of ways. They're not fundamentally challenging the premises of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism. Then you have, I guess, what, you know, post-Zionists, anti-Zionists, etc., I think of sort of the people who write for Jew School, you know, those kinds of.
Just one other comment.
By the way, there's a whole other direction of being a radical critic, in a sense of sort of the established community. And frankly, that's Orthodoxy, in its different forms.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, there's Chabad, which is like a whole other piece of business,
mm-hmm.
but just operates on a very different set of premises from the community. let me put it like this. Orthodoxy operates on a very different set of premises for most of the American Jewish community, and it's the one community whose numbers seem to be growing.
Right.
And Chabad operates on an even more, on a different set of premises, not just from the rest of the Jewish community, but from Orthodoxy. So radicalism and very explicit and implicit critiques of what seemed to be a mainstream, if there, to the extent to which this mainstream center is still holding, can come in a lot of different forms.
It's interesting to think of Orthodox Jews as the most radical Jews today. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but didn't the new Jews in their texts, or weren't there, wasn't there sort of an element of anti-Zionism in their writing as well?
Interestingly, no.
No.
Interestingly, no.
Okay.
No. It's 1971. Mm-hmm. It's 1971. They are, I mean, what's fascinating is that there's one piece in it that's practically, what's it called? I'm holding the book here in my hand, called Israel Without Apology. And it's this rousing defense of Israel. But the other pieces on Israel in the book touch on they explore difficult sides of Israeli life. There's a discussion of a book which in its English translation is known as The Seventh Day, which was a very popular book at the time, book of dialogues by paratroopers after the 67 war, sharing, you know, their difficult experiences of war times and their ambivalences about sort of the militaristic sides of Israeli life and so on and so forth, and it's very sensitively written. Or Gabriel Endy talks about, you know, doing social justice in Israel with Israel's problems, etc. And yet the tone, even the critical tones of about Israel that are sounded in the book are extraordinarily gentle compared to what one hears today. The times have certainly changed in that regard.
I wonder if the question of Israel and the politics that come along with it are something that might mm-hmm. push some Jewish people away from activism and radical thought, and sort of force them into the mainstream of Jewish thought, because they might not be mm-hmm. able to go along with some of the more anti-Zionist rhetoric out there. So
I think that's quite right.
And so, in a sense, the people who are willing to take a more anti-Zionist stance are probably also the people who are more critical and more actively rejecting popular culture and commercialism and all those things. It sort of seems like you kind of have to choose sometimes which side. You know what I mean?
Ways, yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not... I think there are any number of people who would be willing to go farther in social and political critiques of all sorts of things, were it not for the fact that the package seems to be that then you have to be extremely anti-Israel at the same time. You know, and I mean, to be perfectly honest, in some ways I'm sure I fall into that category mm-hmm. as well. I mean, I know that there are very critical impulses of mine about all kinds of things, that, you know, there are publications that I read, et cetera, that I really agree with, you know, on many, you know, in all sorts of like social, economic things, et cetera. But then part of the package is, when part of the package seems to become not just that you have to criticize Israel, because that's okay. I mean, needless to say, it's okay. It's trivial, but it's okay. But you have to hate Israel, too. Not just that Israel is, you know, regularly unjust, immoral, and stupid, but that it's uniquely unjust, immoral, and stupid, and all the time.
Right.
And, you know, unjustifiably so. And so I'm sure that sort of makes it harder for any number of people to sign on to radical, radical agendas. I mean, and the flip question is, you know, does Israel also serve, do Israeli policies, politics, serve to distance people from identifying with Israel and Judaism? A lot of people are pouring a lot of money into studying this sort of what's called the distancing hypothesis.
But basically the distancing hypothesis is the idea that the politics of the state of Israel and all the media attention that it gets are pushing young Jewish people away from just wanting to be Jewish at all.
That's one piece of it. Mm-hmm. That's one piece of it. The other, which is, I think is no small piece of it, is that it's not, is it, well, Israeli politics and policies presumably play a role. Another is just that the nature of identity is changing, and the nature of globalization is changing. I mean, you know, sometimes I call it like the Benetton effect or the Benetton world, right?
Okay.
You know, that right. So think about the world that's conjured up in Benetton ads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this kind of very free-floating, fun, multicultural. You know, it can engage something that can engage in a lot of cultures because it's not deeply attached to any one of them. I mean, think about part of the appeal of Barack Obama is precisely that the guy sort of seemed to hover in this kind of globalized space where he's not really, he's from everywhere. He's from Kenya and he's from Hawaii and he's from Harvard Law School and he's from the south side of Chicago.
Right.
And he's from all of them and he's from none of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a very emblematic figure in that kind of way, in terms of what identity is looking like in an age when all kinds of larger social, economic, et cetera, forces, for good reasons, for bad reasons, for profit-making motives, or just because the way things are, sometimes out of ideology, are sort of loosening people from more fixed and stable identities and attachments, whether it's attachments to a group or to a place.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that young Jewish people today would have a lot to learn from reading this book, The New Jews, from 1971?
Again, I don't presume to dictate reading lists to people who are younger than me, but I say, yeah, you know, I think it would be very interesting. I think it's very interesting for young people today who see themselves as, on the one hand, alienated from, you know, to the extent to which there's young people today who feel alienated from a lot of the formal structures of the community and its institutions on the one hand, and at the same time know that there's some, like, very vibrant thing here that they want to be in touch with, and in part because they might even find, like, radical energies in it. So for young people who feel that, to sort of see how similarly situated young people dealing with kind of the same questions 40 years ago, how they wrote about it. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the book is probably out of print. I mean, I had a copy years ago, which is, I think, in my brother's house in back in New York, and sort of the copy I have here is one that, sort of poetically enough, I found on top of a recycling bin in Jerusalem, you know.
Wow, so it might not be that easy to find it. We might have to go over to your brother's house in New York and see if he lent us a copy.
You'd have to go through a lot of cartons of books, so I'm not sure it would be worth your while.
So that was Yehuda Mirsky talking about The New Jews, and I think it'd be worth my while. I'm definitely going to go down to New York and knock on his brother's door to find the book. I want to read it. So that brings us to the end of the show, and coming up is Noontime Cuts with Butcher T, not to be missed. And thanks for tuning in to Shtetl on the Shortwave. I just want to make one quick announcement before we go out. This Sunday, February 22nd, there's an event called Mystic Madness at the Masquerade Cabaret, and the people organizing it are asking you to celebrate Little Purim, a Jewish holiday that occurs only every 3 or 4 years. And it's going to be a whole event of music, theater, dress up, improvisation, voice, all this to sort of get to know the other side of your ego and of your friend's ego. So that's at the Ghetto Shul this Sunday from 6 to 10 p.m. And for more information about that, you can call 514-484-9314 and talk to Marilyn. So thanks so much for tuning into Shtetl on the Shortwave. And if you want to hear this show or any other shows, just go to shtetlmontreal.com and we're on to Butcher T. And actually, before we get to Butcher T, I'm just, because he's right here trying to find the next song for the song that he's going to play for his show, because I've actually gone over my allotted time. We're gonna hear one last song from Lucy Kaplansky, who's coming to Montreal on March 4th. It's her version of Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash.
is a burning thing. It makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, down, down. Flames went higher and it burns, burns, burns. That ring of fire, that ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, down, down. Flames. Burning thing, it makes a fiery.